This is the Benson at 100, a podcast from the Nettie Lee Benson Latin American Collection at the University of Texas at Austin. The Benson is one of the world's most storied libraries. During this, our centennial year, we explore the people, archives, and collections that built this library. Learn more at benson100.org. That's benson100.org. Thanks for joining us.
Here I come to sing to the beat of my guitar. Because a man who is kept from sleep by an uncommon sorrow comforts himself with singing, like a solitary bird. I beg the saints in heaven to help my thoughts. I beg them here and now as I start to sing my story, that they refresh my memory and make my understanding clear. Come, saints, with your miracles. Come, all of you to my aid, because my tongue is twisting and my sight is growing dim. I beg my God to help me at this hard time.
I have seen many singers whose fame was well won, and after they've achieved it, they can't keep it up. It's as if they'd tired in the trial runs without ever starting the race. But where another criollo goes, Martin Fierro will go too. Nothing sets him back. Even ghosts don't scare him. And since everybody sings, I want to sing also.
And so begins the English translation of José Hernández' epic poem, El Gaucho Martín Fierro, first published in 1872 and the topic of today's conversation. Hi, I'm your host, Pilar Zazueta. Thank you for joining us for this episode of The Benson at 100. Today I'm joined by Daniel Arvino as we go into the Benson's affinity for Argentina's national epic. Daniel, how are you?
I'm doing well. And yourself?
I'm good too. Let's talk about this poem before jumping into its connection to the Benson. Sounds good?
Of course.
When you think about Martín Fierro, what comes to mind?
Why, the freedom of the Pampas and, of course, the gaucho character.
Yes, exactly. Martín Fierro is the story of a gaucho. And for those who do not know what the word means, a gaucho is a horseman, sort of a South American cowboy. In part one of the poem Martín Fierro, he is forced to leave his wife and sons behind on the family ranch when he is illegally drafted to serve at a fort to defend it against the indigenous population. No longer willing to serve in this position, he deserts the army to live among the indigenous he was once coerced into fighting. In part two of the epic, published 7 years later in 1879, Fierro returns to the ranch.
I remember reading this book in a 19th century Latin American literature course where it was put in the framework of romanticism and independence. And those two, that is, romanticism and independence, they go hand in hand, yeah? That spirit of autonomy and idealism where the new nation has broken away from Spain and faces an exciting future of figuring out its identity. Certainly, we have examples of this in the book. The gaucho is this exciting frontiersman who lives by his own moral code. He's the mestizo son of the Spaniard and the indigenous, and the untamed rolling pampas are his home. There's a sense of unbridled freedom in all of this, and one of the illustrated editions that we have at the Benson often depict the gaucho sitting around a fire at night, under the vast sky, drinking yerba mate and swapping stories and songs with other gauchos. But isn't there a dark side to the national epic as well?
Yes, there is. It's not all drinking mate and singing.
Right.
Another aspect of the 19th century Latin American literature was costumbrismo. In this genre, authors were attempting to capture the customs and cultural traditions of groups they thought were disappearing due to contact with the outside world, forced assimilation, and imposed government policies regarding, for example, language and dress. At the time of Hernández' El Gaucho Martín Fierro, with the first part published in 1872 and the sequel in 1879, as I said, there was a real concern that the gaucho was disappearing, or perhaps better said, being disappeared through the government's economic and military policies. Gauchos were constantly conscripted into the military to fight for independence or later on against indigenous nations. Wars and displacement caused population decline in the countryside. Gauchos were forced to abandon their traditional lifestyle in the countryside, and therefore we might think of Hernández' poem as a form of denunciation, of bringing attention to the plight of rural populations who were attempting to adjust to an unfamiliar culture forced upon them by the central government. Many people complained about the changes that occurred after the fall of the caudillo, or military strongman, Juan Manuel de Rosas, in 1852, when Argentina's elite began to implement a so-called politics of progress.
Yeah, for Hernández, the gaucho had been abused, neglected, and finally dispersed, ultimately losing their identity as a social group, all without recognition or justice for the pivotal roles that they played in these wars. The author dedicated much of his life to advocating for gauchos. He grew up in the Argentine country alongside them because his father was an overseer on a cattle ranch. The experience influenced his adult life as he sought justice for them, not only through the poem Martín Fierro, but also in his role as an activist, government official, and journalist. All this to say, yes, the gauchos participated in the extermination of indigenous groups, but from Hernández's perspective, and there's some truth to it, it was often because they were coerced into doing so.
Throughout the 19th century, the state passed laws that led to the criminalization of the gaucho. Cattle ranches were becoming increasingly fenced and privatized, and this meant that there was less need for someone to go round up the cattle because the fences kept the livestock in. Therefore, gauchos, especially the ungovernable or untamed gauchos, began to be seen not as legitimate rural workers or characters of the countryside, but as trespassing vagrants. Beginning in 1822, gauchos had to produce a document stating that they had permission to be on the land, even if they were working. And if they did not produce this document, they would face dire consequences. The criminalization of the gaucho allowed for them to be arrested and punished by serving in wars, especially against indigenous people.
Exactly. These issues appear in El Gaucho Martín Fierro. He lives in poverty on the Pampas. As we see in the book, government officials like judges discriminate against him and ridicule him. There's also racialized violence in the book. As you alluded to, at the beginning of the epic, he is brought against his will to an army fort on the frontier where he is forced to fight against indigenous peoples. After he has fled from the army, he finds himself drunk at a bar where he provokes an Afro-Argentine couple until a fight ensues and he kills the Afro-Argentine man. Fierro also displays animosity toward recent European immigrants whose arrival into the countryside happened in tandem with changes to the cattle ranches, the fencing that we talked about earlier.
Fierro is constantly fleeing from settlements of the dominant modernizing society. At the end of part one, spoiler alert, Fierro and his friend Cruz go to live with an indigenous group. Fierro is wanted for murder, so he's a fugitive, but ultimately he believes he will find more freedom and less oppression among indigenous people, even though he has expressed xenophobic attitudes towards them as well.
Yeah. Well, there can be no spoiler alerts when something has been out for over a century, in my opinion, but yeah, to your point, even this life among the indigenous is short-lived. Cruz and Martín Fierro are not welcomed there, and Cruz and the cacique die from a smallpox plague sweeping the Pampas. Fierro returns to the world he grew up in extremely resigned. The type of work that the gaucho had done in the past on cattle ranches has changed considerably and left them behind. There's a labor shortage because many gauchos were sent to the frontiers to fight indigenous groups, and those who deserted the wars, like Martín Fierro did, they become outlaws.
And this ghost of a previous life quite literally turn up in the second part of the poem. Martin Fierro encounters his two sons, as well as the son of Cruz, his friend. He also meets the son of the Afro-Argentine man he kills in part one, and the two of them participate in a singing duel. It is as if the past is there, but nearly unrecognizable upon his return.
The book was extremely well-received, even upon its first publication. By the time Hernandez released part two, Martin Fierro was already a national bestseller in Argentina and Uruguay. Bookstores carried it, of course, but something that I find very neat is that it was also common to find it being performed in bars and in other public spaces.
Yes, this is very cool. It's really a popular work of literature in that sense. And among major writers, it was viewed as a success too. The great Argentine writer Leopoldo Lugones crowned Argentina's great epic. Jorge Luis Borges, who we never fail to mention in this podcast, wrote several essays called El Martín Fierro, as well as a short story that reimagines the singing duel between Fierro and El Moreno called El Fin, or The End, which also came out in 1953.
Martín Fierro has been the inspiration for several films, for a literary award in Argentina, and even an early 20th century literary journal.
Yes, but let's get to the meat of this conversation. And my pun is intended because Argentine beef is perhaps the best in the world. And we also love to talk about food in this podcast,
yeah,
yes.
For sure.
Anyway, my question is, what is the Benson's relationship with Martin Fierro?
It started off very innocently, as book collecting often does. Our earliest edition was the 11th, which was published in 1878. It is a notable one because of an extensive introduction that discusses the reception of the book in its first 6 years.
Yes, it sold 40,000 copies in its first 10 editions, and nowadays those editions are very difficult to find. The 11th edition also offers copies of letters written by and to Hernandez regarding the book's reception. But you said that was the oldest, the 11th. Do we have an earlier edition than that?
Yeah, it just so happens that in 1961, the Benson added Pedro Martinez Reales's Gaucho Library to the collection. This included 1,500 books, pamphlets, and articles on Gaucho literature. Within the collection was more than 300 printings of José Hernández's seminal work, Martín Fierro. One of those 300-plus editions of Martín Fierro's was a 7th edition from 1874.
Wow, that's incredible.
I would say so, yeah. We also have Walter Owen's manuscript for the return of Martín Fierro. For those that don't know, Owen was a Scot living in Argentina, and he was the first to translate Martín Fierro into English in 1935. As you can imagine, this really opened the book up to a new audience. The manuscript that we have is a typescript with some light annotations on the first couple of pages.
It sounds like Nettie Benson was very interested in the text.
Well,
right?
as usual, you're right. I don't know if it was because Benson drew comparisons between her life in rural Texas and the Argentine Pampas, but she was indeed interested. She wrote an article in 1968 called Martín Fierro at the University of Texas, in which she discusses the importance of the book and its place in the collection. She considers its early publication success and its growing international audience as well.
We hosted a visiting scholar from Argentina here at the University of Texas, the historian Matias Emiliano Casas, who analyzed Nettie Benson's scholarship. Benson said, "The poem is one of protest." She also compared it with Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin. Casas said that Nettie Benson, as a librarian, wanted to give people in the U.S. a sense of the dimension of Hernandez's book. So, Daniel, you talked about 300 different printings in the Martinez Reales collection. Is there anything noteworthy about them?
There are there's just a great diversity to this collection. There are illustrated editions, pocket-sized editions, limited editions. We have translations in English, French, Italian, Lithuanian, Hungarian, Czech, Swedish, German, Catalan, and Arabic. And more on the memorabilia side, there are calendars from the Fábrica Argentina de Alpargatas from 1937, 1938, and 1939, with each month illustrated by a scene from Martín Fierro.
Another archival collection I want to highlight, and I'm giving a shout out to our colleagues at the Harry Ramson Center in Austin, is the Edward Laroque Tinker papers. He was an American writer who created the Tinker Foundation. Thanks to this foundation, 5 universities in the United States were endowed with funds to host prominent Latin American scholars and intellectuals to campus. The University of Texas is one of them. But what is Tinker's connection with Martín Fierro? Well, after a trip to Argentina, Edward Laroque Tinker promoted Martín Fierro in libraries all across the United States. He was very interested in gauchos, as they reminded him of cowboys. Comparing Argentina and the U.S., Tinker said, "Two nations that produce classes of men so alike must have much in common, as well as a strong spiritual kinship." It is interesting how Tinker used the figure of the gaucho to try to help create a sort of Pan-American identity by using the folklore of rugged men from the countryside.
Yeah, these ideas were later revived by Walt Disney. Of course, we all know Disney, the Mickey Mouse fame. He included a gaucho character in some of his animated movies like Saludos Amigos, which was a total propaganda piece. Disney maybe had similar experiences to Tinker when he visited Argentina. Both were entertained with folklore shows, asados, and visits to ranches. A very curated experience, I'm sure. Maybe a nice Malbec from Mendoza, right? And so the gaucho certainly became an object of cultural fascination for North Americans in the 20th century. And I think it makes sense if you consider the popularity of Westerns and spaghetti Westerns in the film industry at this time. As you mentioned, the gaucho offered a figure that Americans could connect with, especially those who were influenced by or enamored of that romanticized and honestly whitewashed Wild West period.
Exactly. There are a lot of cultural connections there, and the way that some scholars and readers interpret them, they also bring an additional dimension of how we see el gaucho Martín Fierro. But on a final note, and speaking about historical archives, I cannot stop, apparently, but it is kind of our thing, yes, in this podcast. In 1921, the National Board of Education of Argentina commissioned teachers from all over the country to conduct a survey of works of poetry, prose, and folk music from each region of the country. Based on the instructions of the Education Board, the teachers had to collect in Spanish or indigenous languages popular traditions, romances, children's songs, and epic military poems about the War of Independence or subsequent civil wars. These surveys are digitalized and available online. The Folklore Survey is a testimony of the rural people of Argentina. So in other words, this collection are the memories of the daughters, sons, and grandchildren of the real 19th century gauchos. We'll include a link to this collection on our show notes because it's very interesting. So everything that we mentioned here are all very important sources to think about El Martín Fierro and about how a book becomes a bestseller and stays in the national and international imagination.
For sure. Yeah, that's really interesting about the archive. I'm looking forward to checking that out a bit more, actually, because it sounds just super fascinating. And to your point, El Martín Fierro, its legacy is still felt to this day. I don't know if you've read this, but there's a book that came out by Argentine writer Gabriela Cabezón Cámara in 2017. It's called Las Aventuras de China Iron, and it reworks Martin Fierro from the perspective of his wife. It tells the story of what happened to her after Martin Fierro was forced to join the army.
Yes, I recall this book being shortlisted for the Booker International Prize.
Yeah, that's the one.
And the UT professor, Gabriela Polit, did a super interesting interview with Gabriela Cabezón Cámara. We'll also link it to the show notes. And it's fascinating. It explores how she was inspired to write this book. So I'll have to add China Iron to my long list of books to read. The Wives of Gauchos, Cowboys, and Charros, all the rogue frontiersmen and rogue horsemen, they also need some recognition.
Absolutely.
Well, and that concludes another episode of the Benson at 100 podcast. Daniel, as always, a pleasure. And to the audience out there, thank you for listening.
The Benson at 100 is a production of Lilas Benson Latin American Studies and Collections at the University of Texas at Austin. To see relevant images and links for today's discussion, as well as to support the Benson Centennial, visit benson100.org. Music for this podcast was composed by Ola Ola. Thanks for tuning in.